is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Tom Joslin, Senior Fellow for the Foundation of the Defense of Democracies, to help me understand the various reports we're getting from Afghanistan and Africa about the activities of the jihadists and the response of the geopolitical powers. I'm thinking of not only the United States, but also members of the European Union, sometimes members of NATO, all looking for a way of dealing with what you'd say is the new Taliban, in that it is demanding money, it is seeking partners with adversaries such as China and other bad actors, and the reports. Tom, a very good morning to you. I read from the BBC reporting in these last days. The U.S. and a host of allied countries have called on the Taliban to end the targeted killings of former members of Afghan security forces. In a joint statement, 22 nations demanded that the Islamist regime respect its pledge not to harm former government or security personnel. The statement went on to say, "We are deeply concerned by reports of summary killings and enforced disappearances." This report is released by Human Rights Watch. Tom, the question here is, what is surprising about this? Who is surprised by this? We know that the Taliban is Murder Incorporated. It's practiced that for 20 years. We also know that we anticipated there would be revenge killings. There are more things being reported, but this seems to be centerpiece right now of the protest. To your knowledge, Tom, what are we looking at here? Are we looking at a large-scale campaign? Are we looking at revenge killings within families? Is there any good information coming?
Well, you know, John, I think it's important to put this in context. You remember that throughout the years of diplomacy between the U.S. and the Taliban, the U.S. and the now deposed Afghan government begged the Taliban for a ceasefire many, many times, over and over again. And the Taliban refused to do so, refused to even to have any kind of meaningful ceasefire whatsoever. And their reasoning was that the Afghan government was merely a puppet of the U.S. They were infidels and apostates, and they needed to be defeated. I don't think anyone should be surprised that an organization that has that attitude toward the former Afghan government would continue with their agenda of forced disappearances, assassinations, murders, and the like. I mean, I think this is all entirely unsurprising, in other words. And so the fact that the international community is sort of expressing surprise in any regard, or that implying or arguing that the Taliban has somehow reneged on its promise not to do this, well, I think that's kind of foolish. I mean, this is what the Taliban's been all about all along.
Yes, the Taliban is described variously as an Islamist regime. We used to refer to it as gangsters, as exploiters of people's dignity and now their lives, because we have this additional report from the New York Times that goes in tandem with the suspect revenge killings or harms. Quoting, just as during past changes in government, distributing property to Taliban disciples in swaths of rural farmland and in desirable urban neighborhoods has turned into at least a short-term recourse to keep stability within the Taliban ranks. Who has the guns gets the land, said Patricia Gosman, the Associate Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. It's an old, long-continuing story. Tom, the sense that I get from reading these reports is this is the Taliban we knew of. This is the Taliban you and Bill and your colleagues have been reporting on for 20 years. This is not a government. This is ungoverned space in the hands of anarchists, gangsters, and thieves. In this instance, they're not only taking lives, they're taking land. To your reporting at the Long War Journal, was there any doubt in the minds of either the Trump administration negotiating with the Taliban or the Biden administration negotiating with the Taliban that this is where we were headed? Did people introduce the possibility that the Taliban had changed and therefore these worries were not appropriate?
Well, I mean, I think the State Department across administrations has certainly trafficked in really just nonsense about the Taliban. There was all sorts of attempts to portray the Taliban as a new Taliban, and they made all sorts of excuses for its bad behavior. One of the talking points was that they, because they'd want international legitimacy and they're going to want international aid, they wouldn't do all the things you just talked about, all the things that are now being documented as they're doing. And, you know, part of my frustration in covering this for so long, John, is that part of what I realize is sort of the dysfunction of Washington is that there's no accountability for people who get it wrong. So basically, there are officials who vouch for the Taliban's counterterrorism assurances, vouch for the Taliban as a government, you know, as being somewhat responsible as a government and in various other ways. And even though there was no good reason to believe in those assurances at the time, and there was plenty of contradictory evidence that those people were ignoring, in a sense, or downplaying, as these stories come to light now, as more and more evidence accumulates that all that was a fiction all along, there won't be any accountability for the people that sold that bill of goods. And I'm thinking of, you know, for example, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's still making the media rounds, John. This is the guy who sold out the government in Kabul to the Taliban and is still making excuses for the Taliban on national TV and in various media appearances. I mean, this is a guy who should be recognized widely now for what he is, as at a minimum, an abject failure, and that his entire diplomatic scheme was a failure. And yet somehow he still has some credibility or is treated as somehow an expert on these things when really he just failed.
In April, when the president announced the decision to leave by September 11th, that was the headline in April. Was there evidence of either the State Department or the DOD or some element of NATO? NATO was involved. ISAF was involved. Writing a counterpoint. Oftentimes, these studies include a wide range of opinions about what the future held if and when this happened. Did you see dissent, Tom, in any of those large organizations?
You know, I think the dissent was mainly private, John, and nobody had the guts to stand up for their dissent. So part of what Bill and Roggio, my colleague, and I have talked about for a long time is that if you think a policy is wrong and you can't execute it, then you have a responsibility of saying something. It doesn't mean you step outside the chain of command. We have civilian authority in the United States of America for good reasons. But if you're, you know, a top general, like, for example, you'll see, you know, Austin Scotty Miller, who was the last American general for this failed war effort in Afghanistan. You can see now that based on various press reports that he had various misgivings or criticisms of the policies under both Trump and then Biden. Well, the thing is, you know, general, you're in charge of the war. If you think this is a losing effort, you think this is doomed to fail, which is what we were saying, then you can resign. You can go do something else with your life. You can resign and protest. You can stand up for what you think is right. But he didn't do that. In fact, you basically have a lot of this, you know, basically trying to cover their bases now after the fact and trying to pretend like that they don't own this policy when in fact they do. So in other words, John, I'm sure there were more dissents that I'm not even aware of from NATO, from within the U.S. military, from others. But they didn't really, first of all, they didn't have the type of clarity to make that dissent stick. And second of all, they didn't make it public. They didn't really actually do what they should have done to stand up for what they thought was right.
Now we come to the money. Follow the money. This is Reuters reporting in these last days. Donors to the World Bank-administered Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund, ARTF, have agreed to decide about a transfer of funds to humanitarian aid agencies by December 10th, a World Bank spokesperson said. The World Bank's board this week backed transferring $280 million from the $1.5 billion trust fund, which was frozen after the Taliban took over the Afghan government in August, to the World Food Program and UNICEF, Reuters reported on Wednesday. It appears that the transnational organization, the World Bank, and World Food Program at the UN and UNICEF are looking to find a way to put aid, chiefly food, into a country that is now widely reported as not on the edge of starvation, but actually plunging into starvation. There's an estimate that from the New York Times, nearly 4 months since the Taliban seized power, Afghanistan is on the brink that of mass starvation that aid groups say threatened to kill a million children this winter. So, Tom, I believe what we have here is an effort for the Taliban to find money in some fashion, even if it comes in the form of food aid. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking with Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a senior fellow. We're talking about the few reports we have coming out of Afghanistan of a crisis that only grows larger during these winter months. When we come back, we're going to turn to the larger Islamist questions about Al-Qaeda in Syria and in Africa. This is John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jossin, Senior Fellow for the Foundation of the Defense of Democracies, with Bill Rojo, his colleague. They keep the Long War Journal. And the Long War Journal, focusing these many years on the war in Afghanistan, and before that, the war in Iraq. Now we turn attention to Syria. And this is from these last days from the DOD. U.S. Central Command has launched an investigation after a drone strike against a senior Al-Qaeda leader in northwest Syria may have killed civilians. Tom, I highlight this because it is a demonstration that the DOD continues to hunt with its drones, in this case an MQ-9 Reaper, hunt the leadership of Al-Qaeda. So always good at any point to pull up and say, what is the opinion at Central Command, at CENTCOM, or at the DOD of Al-Qaeda? Is it a growing organization? Is it a functioning organization? Is it located only in Syria? What do they say of their official manhunt?
I think the bottom line, John, is that CENTCOM and the U.S. government in general are not providing a lot of details about Al-Qaeda globally or with respect to Syria. They're just not explaining to the American public what they think Al-Qaeda is at this point or how it's structured or who's who. You notice the statement that came out about this drone strike in Syria, they were quick to highlight the possibility of civilian casualties. That's undoubtedly a response to the growing press criticism or media inquiries about civilian casualties that went unreported in previous strikes. And so they're trying to get on top of that or out in front of that story as it is with this latest strike. But they didn't provide very much information or sort of background info on who was even targeted in Syria. They just described this person as a senior Al-Qaeda planner or leader of some sort, but they don't give any biographical details. They don't explain how he fits into Al-Qaeda's scheme. They don't say exactly what they thought he was doing. They just sort of try and have you take their word for it that he really was an Al-Qaeda guy. Now, look, I don't have the extreme skepticism that some people within the hard left or even now the growing isolationist right have when it comes to these things. Al-Qaeda has a presence in Syria. I know that there are targets or people that could be targeted by the U.S. in a self-defense sort of capacity. But it's really incumbent on the U.S. government to explain this to the American people, explain who was targeted and why. And if it was a mistake, then it was a mistake. But these things need to be full transparency on this, I would say. And, you know, John, I mean, look at that press statement that the CENTCOM put out. Did you learn anything from that about who this Al-Qaeda leader is? It's just very general, you know.
It struck me also as outside of the reporting that's going on about Syria, the Assad regime, Russia, Turkey, Idlib province, and the concerns that our ally Israel has about Iran using Syria as a base for the transfer of its extremely sophisticated missiles that are flowing into Hezbollah. In other words, almost as if there are independent conflicts going on all in the same GPS, and there's no need to relate to the other conflicts. How does Al-Qaeda have anything to do, if it does, with the opposition to the Assad regime or the convergence of Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria? Tom, I could go on. You know these things. I know them, but there's no explanation as to why this guy, using an MQ Reaper, a very sophisticated machine, in Idlib province, which is itself an ungoverned space, no attempt to explain to the American people whatsoever what we're paying for.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, John. I mean, this is, in fact, Idlib, I would just say I agree with all that except for one thing. I think Idlib is a governed space. It's governed by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, this, a group that's sort of an Al-Qaeda offshoot. It's murky at this point. There's been a lot of tension and a lot of rivalry and conflict between the HGS leadership and Al-Qaeda senior leadership, even though the head of HGS was formerly loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda. But, you know, the U.S. government isn't really explaining that at all. Isn't explaining, you know, what Hayatullah al-Sham is all about today, isn't explaining the relationship or lack thereof with Al-Qaeda senior leadership, isn't explaining how this guy was able to exist in land and territory controlled by HGS. And I think that all gets into you're talking about the geopolitics of it, John. That gets into these thorny issues of the relationship between HGS and Turkey, which is its prime sponsor in Syria, and, you know, and what the whole revolution against the Assad regime was really all about. You know, one of the things that Bill and I talked about very early on was we were documenting the role of extremists, of jihadists in the uprising against Assad going back to late 2011. And certainly, you know, the uprising started with the ordinary Syrian people, but what we detected very early on was that the most dedicated, the most efficient, the most lethal factions were in fact jihadists or extremists. And you had a lot of people in the West who were trying to look the other way on that and pretend that wasn't the case. Well, it was the case. And so that's not a defense of Assad, but it's just an expression of reality or recognition of reality. And to this day, what you have basically, there is no non-extremist opposition to Assad that's viable. It is basically all extremists or jihadists at this point. And the U.S. government isn't really explaining to the American people who's who or how this all works. And so you have these drone strikes that pop up on occasion in Idlib province, and there's really little connective tissue or explanatory narrative given for them.
Is it possible to understand why the DOD would sign off on an MQ-9 Reaper for one man in Idlib province and how that connects to a threat to the homeland? Do those dots ever connect anymore, Tom? Or is it just, it's like bounty hunting. It feels like the old West here, you know, wanted dead or alive, and there's no other explanation offered.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could connect, John, today, but they're not explaining it. That's the main thing. And you know, the thing is, there has been a consistent stream of threats out of Syria at times. You can point to threats to Europe and to the U.S. We've documented that at Long War Journal. There's definitely a body of evidence there. But what the current status of that is really not clear at all, and is not being explained by the U.S. And this is the point about all this, is that I think that when the U.S. government takes actions like this and doesn't actually explain what happened or why it's doing it or provide a full narrative about to justify its actions, it just fuels the discontent and the rejections of it. And so, you know, I think that that's a mistake. I think either there has to be full transparency and a full explanation, a full buy-in from Congress about what's going on here, or you don't do it, is my view.
This connects in my mind to that drone strike that was used in the last hours in Kabul, where they said they were interrupting a planned attack on American personnel, and it turned out to be a family loading water. This is two notable mistakes in a row. So in these 30 seconds, is there a mood in Congress to call this off, to say, unless you explain this, we can no longer vouchsafe it? We have 30 seconds, Tom.
I think there is an effort in Congress to do that. My view is that I actually agree with critics who say that there needs to be a repeal and then a reauthorization of the authorization for use of military force, the 2001 law that allows the U.S. military to conduct such strikes. I think there needs to be strict oversight of these issues, and I think that maybe that's the way to do it.
Tom Jostlin, the drone strikes continue in Africa as well, which we'll speak to in future, of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies with Bill Rojo and their colleagues. They keep the Long War Journal a chronicle of the episodes now in and around Afghanistan we can document, and then Al-Qaeda in Africa, Al-Qaeda throughout the Ummah. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.